Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and he and I are recording this show on Sunday, March 1st, 2020. Very special day, folks. Drew's birthday. Happy birthday, by the way, Drew.
Thank you so much, Jim. I am one day older and deeper in debt, as the old song goes. That you know, as you know well.
Yes, it's, the interesting thing, it's not just a big day for you, it's a big week, because this Tuesday, March 3rd, your very first book, The Art of Onward, is hitting store shelves.
Yes, did you pre-order your copy, Jim?
No. I'm doing the support your local bookstore thing. I am literally going out on Tuesday the 3rd, going to my local Barnes & Noble and buying a copy. Now, mind you, I'm buying in New Hampshire, so I'm not paying sales tax. But, you know, but I am buying locally.
I love that.
And very, very, very much looking forward to paging through this 176-page hardcover.
Well, I will caution people to not look at it until after they watch the movie. Because you're gonna get some things spoiled if you jump the gun, but yeah,
that's a good point.
But apparently, a lot of people went and saw the little sneak they had this past week. So, you know.
Speaking of which, we were talking about this earlier. I'm an idiot. Okay, I had assumed that the sneak preview would be on Saturday night. So I had some family stuff that I had to do Saturday afternoon, and it's like, okay, cool. I can, now we can go see Onward. And so I start looking for theaters that are having the sneak preview, which they presented at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at every theater in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I think some theaters had a Pixar marathon that they were doing that, and then Onward didn't show, I think, until 7 or maybe even 9. But those seemingly were few and far between. But yeah, it was sort of weird that it was so early. I think those screenings had the Simpsons short attached as well, although I haven't heard anybody talk about it yet.
And we will get to that. Let's back up the truck a little bit. I mean, look, I get you've written so many wonderful entertainment-related series over the past decade. I can understand why Chronicle reached out to you to do this book. But can you talk a little bit about how you got this opportunity? Because weren't you initially in the running with a couple of other writers?
Pixar was the one that suggested me. Apparently what happened was there was another author on the book, and they left. They got another job. And so there was this incredible time crunch. And so Pixar said, well, why don't you call Drew? And so that's what started it. And I sort of had to submit some writing samples. And it also helped that I was up at Pixar all the time anyway for work, just covering things. And so it was about this time last year. And it was quick.
Well, speaking of quick, though, Drew kind of swore me to secrecy when this project was in the works. But I remember you talking about how from when you said yes to you then had to go up to Pixar like immediately.
Oh, yeah.
I
basically said, well, I'm going to be up there for Toy Story 4. And they said, well, that's great because your deadline is about 2 weeks after that. So, It was a very interesting process and a really illuminating process, but it was great to work with everybody at Pixar and there's some editors at Pixar who really helped get the book kind of in final form as you will read it. I wish I had been in the process longer. You know, I saw it a year ago, and then I saw it at the premiere a couple weeks ago. So that was it. I wish I could have sort of seen it transform, because even when I was doing the interviews, they were saying, oh, it's different than the version you saw yesterday. It's like, okay, all right.
And speaking of which, what you told me is that, when you saw it, they were literally, two scenes that had been animated?
Yeah,
and
I think there were two scenes, yeah.
Was in boards.
Yeah. And I was really worried because it was like, oh boy, I'm going to have a hard time even talking to people about this if I don't know what it looks like. It was a beautiful movie and storyboard, so I was so happy to get this assignment because it's a really special movie. You know, it's the first original Pixar film since 2017, and I think that means a lot, and I think the movie's going to mean a lot to people. So I'm very excited to have a very, very small contribution to that story.
Well, no, look, that's the thing. You went up when people are in the middle of producing this film, and in fact, they carved out one day of interviews, and you basically went from, the director to designer to, you know, and just made your way through as many members of the crew. And then you had to go home and transcribe all of those notes and then find, in fact, that's the other thing I remember you describing. Basically, you had to create the text that went around the images that had already been selected, right?
Yeah. Or, I mean, what's interesting about this is the first book that's actually had an author since 2013 with Brave. So I got to write a lot more than most people, which is great. So I get to do the chapters and I got to do the captions. But yeah, it's a fascinating process, and I loved it. It was a really wonderful experience for sure.
Well, now speaking of which, though, okay, so you do your part, you write the text, you hand it off to the folks at Chronicle, and then you're in literally the slow boat to China territory, because again, the books get printed over there and shipped back to the States, and but
they're here though, Jim. They made it.
They are here. Yes. They are here. but I have to ask, one day a package shows up in the mail for you. So what was that like to actually be able to hold in your hands, you know, that book?
It was pretty amazing. I didn't know what it was. And Katie, my wife, was like, oh my God, this is the book. Like, she knew before we had opened it. So it was really, really exciting. I can't wait for people to have it too. I mean, it's just so surreal because one of the very first art of books I had as a kid was the Art of Toy Story book. You remember the one with the lenticular cover?
Yes.
It was taller.
I have it to this day because it is so big.
Yeah.
Whenever I put it on a bookshelf, I have to lay it on its side
because
there isn't a shelf on the planet that's tall enough to fit the thing.
Yes. The Bugs Life one is weirdly shaped too, but now they've kind of gotten more uniform. But you know, to have this sitting next to all those other great art of books that, you know, you and I both reference all the time is a great feeling.
Well, again, I'm just so thrilled that you had this opportunity and just I cannot wait to get my hands on it. Speaking of which, folks, I want to remind you, today is Drew's birthday. And me personally, I can think of no better present to give Mr. Taylor than if all of us to either go out to our local bookstores and buy a physical copy of The Art of Vanguard, or if you're kind of concerned about the coronavirus, you know, just hop on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com and order yourself a copy of this handsome hardcover. And speaking of the coronavirus, Drew, you know, as longtime listeners of Fine Tuning will know, this isn't the only podcast that you do. The Light the Fuse show, which is about the Mission Impossible film franchise and the original series. And we were just talking on our last episode about how, what is it, Mission Impossible 7 had begun shooting in Venice, but all that changed like 5 days ago, right?
Yeah. I mean, they shut down production, sent everybody home. Tom wasn't out there yet, so he stayed here. But yeah, I mean, it's the only thing that can stop Mission Impossible is the coronavirus. It's nothing else. But I worry about the release date. You know, there's a lot of questions going on. I think they're using this time to really finish fine-tuning Top Gun 2, which a lot of the same people are involved in. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. But we got a lot of great shows coming up, so listen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, the language that Paramount is using at this point is temporary shutdown.
Yes. Production has been suspended, but not canceled.
All right. Well, I guess, again, the cover entertainment is one thing you can count on is change. And speaking of change, you know, again, and just in the past week, we had Bob Iger. Effective immediately from Monday, February 24th, Bob announced that he's stepping down as chairman and CEO of the Walt Disney Company and handing the reins over to Bob Chapek, who previously had been chairman of Disney Parks Products and Experiences. And we were just talking about, it's weird that Bob isn't leaving. He's staying through the end of 2021. As he explains it, he's focusing on Disney's creative endeavors and working under the title of executive chairman.
Yeah. What a weird day, Jim, that was.
Well, and now, didn't you write a piece for Collider just last week, you know, sort of explaining Bob Chapek's history at the company and his background and that sort of thing? And
yeah, people don't really know who he is besides freaks like you and me. So I kind of wanted to bring him up and sort of elevate his profile a little bit, at least so that you get an understanding of what to expect maybe from the next few years of Disney. I don't know. It's very interesting. But yeah, that's on Collider right now. And you know, this is a guy that started in home video.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I, of course, again, just pivoted and began digging down into his career. And Chapek actually takes great pride in the work that he did in the Air Bud, Air Buddies Santa Paws thing for home entertainment. And I was kind of surprised. There have been, what, there were the initial two theatrical releases for Air Bud, and then there were three home premieres, then seven Air Buddy home premieres, and then two Santa Paws movies. And
yeah, I was working in a video store during this period, mm-hmm. Jim, and every time a new one would come in, it would be like, mm-hmm. there's really another one, you know, Spooky Buddies and, you know, mm-hmm. all these other spin. I mean, it never ended, Jim.
But the reason that was is they were, I guess they cost nothing to shoot. They always shot them in Canada, you know, pulled the films together, religiously low budget, and they'd always sell because, you know, cute little, especially the Air Buddies one, and they'd always return a tidy profit, which was why, you know, virtually as one's out the door, the next one's going. But again, we were just talking about the coronavirus, but do you remember that story from February of 2008 when they were, I guess, shooting Snow Buddies? And, you know, word came out that, I guess, parvovirus had swept the set in Vancouver, and they lost, I guess, five of the puppies. And PETA claimed that as many as 40 or 50 of the puppies that they use over the course of shooting a film like that had been affected by the virus. And
parvo is no joke. That's yeah. when you get a dog these days, that's something that you really have to keep an eye on. So mm-hmm. I had not heard that story, but I now having a puppy of my own, it's I know how serious it is.
Well, and wasn't it like just last week they were talking about how a dog in Hong Kong had tested positive for corona? So
well, the theory is that the coronavirus came from somebody eating animal meat. Dog is a meat market dog, so I know all about this stuff. She's off the menu, Jim.
There we go. Okay, just to circle back to Mr. Chapek. So he reportedly played a very large role in the launch of Disney Plus, the subscription streaming service, which is Disney's answer to Netflix. Now, speaking of Netflix, you were talking about Guillermo del Toro's Wizards of Arcadia?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, he tweeted last week that it will be coming summer 2020, mm-hmm. which I'm very excited about because I feel like it's been forever since Three Below ended. Mm-hmm. Are you caught up on these series, Jim?
I literally just finally sat down and watched Farmageddon, which, by the way, you were right. Absolutely charming and really is the modern equivalent of a silent film.
I
think the only time you really get anybody sort of talking is the farmer. Uh-huh. And he basically, you know. On the other hand, also watched, at this point, I've seen two of the episodes of Star Wars Clone Wars Season 7. Mm-hmm. And I have to ask, I'm looking forward to talking with Dan Z later this week to find out why there, you know, especially at a moment where you're bringing, you know, a lot of folks in the door. They started with the storyline that is so inside baseball. Mm-hmm. For Star Wars, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the animation. The art direction is amazing. Good voice work. But I'm now getting concerned about, or supposed to get concerned about, Captain Rex and, you know, and his friend who got captured and Echo something. You know, I mean, that's always the story they tell about New Hope, is that Lucas deliberately picked that story because it was the easiest entry point.
Right.
To the Star Wars universe. And I feel like this one, it's like, okay, this is an episode. In fact, I saw a couple of pieces online to the effect of, these are the 10 episodes you have to watch of Star Wars Clone Wars before you watch Season 7. And it's just sort of like, I don't want to do homework before I watch animation.
It's really weird that they chose that, the story. Mm. I guess what's interesting, too, is that the first episode has been released before. Mm. In 2015 in the Lost episodes, but in animatic form. Yeah. So they're
That's right.
Yeah. So your qualms remind me of, have you been watching Picard on CBS All Access?
I have been cheating. I'm waiting till they finish so I can sit and binge it all.
Okay, well, talk about something that is not designed for anybody who has even a passing understanding of Star Trek. I mean, it is full of so many deep cuts, and it's like, this is really your approach? You're paying what's his name, $10 million an episode, and this is how you're inviting people back? Patrick Stewart, yeah. So anyway.
All right. So now to double back to Guillermo. So Wizards of Arcadia, so we know it's coming in 2020, but you had heard that potentially on the other side of the series, there's a movie?
Yeah, I heard this for a little while now, and then actually somebody who listens to the show stopped me in a Target. They were like, not theatrical, man, not theatrical. So I'd been speculating about whether it would be like that Spirit Riding Free movie and actually go theatrical, but it is not. It is going to be on Netflix, but it will culminate in the whole world. And I am a huge fan of all of these shows, so I'm very excited.
Well, while we're talking Netflix and animation, of course, we've talked previously in the show about Hilda, which is returning for a second season at some point on Netflix. I'm hearing late 2020, but the reason I bring this up is just last month, they had Toy Fair down at the Javits Center, the worst convention center in the history of the world. And among the things that were on display there were the Hilda toys and collectibles that Gund and Silvergate will be putting on its store shelves later this year.
We need that little deer creature. That's all we need. Her little cohort, whatever.
No, that's very cute. Well, in fact, I think I saw somebody's done plush of that.
Have you been watching Kippo and the Wonder Beasts on Netflix yet?
Not yet. Okay. Not yet.
We'll do a catch-up episode.
Okay. I just got Clone Wars done. Well, and speaking of convention centers and large places that people meet, you know, a good chunk of L.A. was at the Staples Center this past Monday, the 24th, for Kobe Bryant's memorial service. And did you see that story that sort of came out last week? Bruce W. Smith, he's the creator of the Proud Family and also worked on Hair Love. How I guess he and Sergio Pablos, the creator director of Netflix Klaus, had dinner with Kobe a few weeks ago, and they were discussing. I guess Bryant wanted to set up an animation studio and was trying to convince these two guys to come over and do projects for his studio. And while we're talking about Bruce, you must have seen the Disney Plus announcement that the Proud Family is being revived. And what is it? The Proud Family Louder and Prouder. And it's headed to Disney Plus. I guess Ralph Farquhar, who also did the show with Bruce, is back on board as well. But it's been 18 years now since we've had new episodes. And
Louder and Prouder, Jim. Louder and Prouder.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting because members of the Proud Family can't go on Instagram and complain about their show going to Hulu instead, you know, so. Sorry, yeah. Lizzie. I know Lynn is a big Lizzie McGuire fan, which is, you know, maybe deserves some investigation all its own, but it looks like that's having some problems now, but hopefully they get back on track and we get to see it sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Disney Plus, in a moment we're going to talk about a movie that's about to make its debut on Disney Plus.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Got your happy price line.
Okay, we were just talking about Onward, and this news broke over the weekend or thereabouts, but for the first time ever, you know, when a Pixar film comes out, there's not going to be, the first time since Toy Story, the original Toy Story, there's not going to be a Pixar short in front of it.
Well, there wasn't a Pixar short in front of Toy Story 4.
That's an interesting point. was that deliberate?
I think so. And if there wasn't one in front of Coco, because not to bring up the Frozen Christmas special in the fiasco of 2017. But that was in front of that. I don't think there was... I'm trying to think if there was even something in front of Cars 3. Hmm. So they've been sort of allocating that short film real estate now for Disney Plus.
Which was the one Lost and Found? The Lou.
Lou was in front of Lou was in front of Cars, and Bao was in front. What was Bao in front of?
Incredibles 2.
Yes.
Well, all right. Sorry, folks. We're getting in the weeds here, but what's going to be out in front of Onward is a Simpsons short. I guess it's called Playdate with Destiny. And Onward arrives in theaters this Friday, March 6th. But again, this is Disney really leaning into that we are going to make use of 20th century's animation assets. In fact, I was just at the Disney store this past Friday, and I got to tell you, Drew, it was a little strange to be standing in there and, you know, how they have that in-store video loop which touches on every single theme park and cruise line. And in the middle of this here is an extended clip from Spies in Disguise. And I guess the Blu-ray and DVD of that goes on sale March 10th. But the big news is that Ice Age, Blue Sky's very first animated feature, which was released to theaters way back in March of 2002, that debuts, in fact, as a birthday present. Drew, it's on Disney Plus as of today.
Oh, and, yay. You
know, well, I know we mentioned earlier that the Easter special from 2016, the Ice Age, the Greatest Eggscapade, has been airing there for a while. And I thought we might take a few minutes to talk about how a lot of people seem to have forgotten the big part that Ice Age played in what happened at feature animation in the early 2000s. And in fact, in a weird sort of way, it was a very significant domino that when that one fell, there were layoffs, there were significant staff changes, and this was all because of its opening weekend. Ice Age had been projected to make just $30 million, and the film actually wound up selling 46.3 million worth of tickets domestically over that opening weekend. And now, to put that in perspective, that right off the bat, put Ice Age in a very significant position. If you're comparing opening weekends, there are only two other films, animated films, that made more money than that. This window of time, the late 1990s, early 2000s, and Monsters, Inc., which came out in November of 2001, that sold $62 million worth of tickets over its opening weekend. And then there was the Toy Story 2, which came out in November of 99, and that sold 57.4 million tickets. So to have Ice Age come out and sell 46 million worth of tickets over its opening weekend, that really caught Disney's attention. And look, given your time at Oh My Disney, and you know, you had to work with all of the different franchises, and did you ever try to get anything going with, you know, some of the films that were made during this era, like Treasure Planet or Atlantis the Lost Empire?
Yeah, I mean, I thought I did a really fun piece about Mike Mignola's designs for Atlantis.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
I think I'm one of the only people that has actually gotten him to talk about that at length. Mm-hmm. And then anytime we did anything Treasure, there's a very dedicated Treasure Planet following.
And as there should be. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's face it, when that came out in theaters, that very same year, the Ice Age comes out in March of 2002, Treasure Planet comes out in November of that year, and it cost Disney $140 million to make. And its opening weekend, it only sold, and again, this is in all of North America, 12 million in tickets.
Ooh.
And wasn't it like that they report the box office on Monday, and I guess Tuesday, didn't they take like a $75 million write-down on the movie?
Ooh. Oh, yikes. Yeah. I didn't realize it was that big of a flop, but...
Well, you know, I think honestly, it wasn't so much that it was that big of a flop. It was the fact that it had opened on what, the exact same day as Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, which, you know, obviously dominated the box office. And, you know, there was just this feeling at Disney that we're out of touch. You know, we're, you know, and I think I'm wrong. Treasure Planet is still a movie that holds up. I enjoyed it the first time I watched it. I, you know, whatever it's on. I mean, mind you, I'm sure there are people at Disney who wish that they had been able to actually get Sean Connery to do the voice of Long John Silver. You know, I don't know if that would have helped sell tickets, but, you know, even by this point, though, when, to double back to March of 2000, when Ice Age came out, 10 days after that movie was released to theaters was when word came down that they were going to have yet another massive layoff at Disney. And the weird thing, Drew, is Disney had been downsizing since January of 1999. That was when Peter Schneider, who had been in charge of animation at Disney since, what, as far back as The Little Mermaid?
Yeah.
He got moved over to handling all of Walt Disney Studios. And his good right arm, Tom Schumacher, took over the making of animated features. And, you know, don't get me wrong, Tom has done some amazing work. He actually left Disney in January of 2003, or rather left Disney Animation and went over to run what was then known as Buena Vista Theatrical Group, the folks who do the shows for Broadway. But he wasn't necessarily a movie guy. I mean, in fact, have you ever heard that story about where Don Hahn, Kirk Weiss, and Gary Trousdale go in to sell, you know, that they've been already working on Atlantis since, you know, they completed Hunchback. And so, you know, sitting down with the new boss and bringing him up to speed about the film they're working on. And so they basically start the pitch off with, you know, well, this is kind of a Ray Harryhausen movie. And, you know, Schumacher interrupts them and it's like, well, who's Ray Harryhausen?
That explains a lot, Jim.
Yeah. It kind of breaks your heart. But anyway, to get back, when Schneider leaves, Disney at that point has 2,200 employees working in feature animation in Burbank, in Paris, Orlando. And, you know, let's not forget about the studios that are doing the direct-to-video stuff in Canada and Australia and the like, in Japan. Anyway, Eisner at this point is looking at how, since Lion King, you know, there's been this, you know, that was the peak earner for Disney in the 1990s. But if you go from Pocahontas to Hunchback to Hercules, almost it looks like a set of stairs, you know, if you put the grosses next to one another. You know, look, Tarzan sort of reversed that trend. But at the same time, Eisner was kind of reading the handwriting on the wall and, you know, sat down with Schumacher and said, you have to lower headcount. We have to. And also, more to the point, you have to be the guy who, when we signed all those contracts, you know, those rock star contracts with animators back in 94, 95 to keep them from going to DreamWorks with Jeffrey, you have to renegotiate salaries with these guys and get them to cut their pay that we've agreed to give them by 30 to as much as 50%. Anyway, long story short, he manages to reduce the headcount from 2,200 to 1,300. But as soon as Ice Age comes out, and again, within 10 days, word comes down, they're going to cut another 300 people to bring it down to 1,000 employees. And then, as I mentioned, January 2003, Schumacher, you know, once again, is asked by Eisner, you know, we need to make some additional cuts, especially on the heels of what just happened with Treasure Planet. And Schumacher, who had been part of the team that had built up Walt Disney Animation Studios to the point that they could make movies like Lion King and, you know, Hunchback and the like, it's just he couldn't do it. So that's the thing. It's like, you know what? I'm just going to go over to theatrical and you're going to have to bring somebody else in here to do that. And that's when they bring in David Staten, who I'm sure you remember, Drew. Yeah. You know,
not a beloved figure in the history of Walt Disney Animation Studios, but yeah.
Well, think about it. They announce, you know, that Schumacher's leaving, and that Staten, again, previously the head of Walt Disney Television Animation, and, you know, in fact, in a weird sort of way, I'm sure he and Chapek must have worked together quite a bit because David had previously done a lot of the home premieres, the sequels, like Return to Neverland. And, you know, he's installed January 2003, and it's 9 days later. He's down in Orlando and lets the staff at Walt Disney Feature Animation Florida know that they're closing the studio. You know, that in 4 months' time, they're going to shut it down, and that only a handful of folks are going to have jobs going forward, because the new plan is that Disney Animation Studio is cutting back to just one production unit, and they're all going to be based in Burbank. And I think Mark Ken was literally like one of three or four people who got that offer and then went back to California.
Yeah, although Chris Sanders was one of them too, who just did Call of the Wild, the very expensive Call of the Wild. There were a few. Byron Howard was from Florida.
That's right. But you think about the very projects that they were working on. I mean, ultimately, Chris leaves the company because that's when Lasseter comes through the door. Yeah. Lasseter doesn't want to make American Dog. That's how he wound up with Bolt. And poor Byron. Isn't Byron the one who was doing My People's?
Oh, was he involved with My... I didn't remember him doing... Who was involved with My People's? I mean, that we should do a whole episode on My People's.
No, definitely. That's actually one of the saddest stories, because there's so much. You know, in fact, if you Google My People's, A Few Good Ghosts, what is it, Angel and Her No Good Sister, because this thing had like three or four different names. There's actually, I want to say, like, upwards of like 10 minutes of animation.
Oh, yeah. There was also that book that Disney actually put out.
Oh, yeah.
Which didn't have as much art as you would want, but it was pretty interesting. Barry Cook.
There we go. The other thing that Staton basically put out there was that they had two films that were moving forward that were too far along in production really to shut down at that point. You had Brother Bear, which was going to be out in theaters October of 2003, and you had Home on the Range, which was going to arrive in theaters in April of 2004. But at that point, Disney was out of the hand-drawn business. In fact, starting in October of 2005, with the release of Chicken Little, Disney was going to do only CG films, so it could then be on a more competitive footing with DreamWorks Animation and Blue Sky. But of course, all of that changes in January 2006, when Disney buys Pixar for, you know, $7.4 billion. And I want to say David Staton literally left that week, didn't he? They made the deal and he was out the door. At some point, speaking of things we have to do deep dives about, you know, especially now that we're in the post-John Lasseter era, there's so much stuff that we can now talk about that John was behind. Like, remember when it was like Disney made hand-drawn films or computer animated films? Disney made traditionally animated films.
Yes.
And computer animated films. And then when John came through the door, suddenly the language changed. Now it was hand-drawn films and CG films, right?
Yes. I remember that.
Yeah.
I don't really understand that or what the distinction is, but you could tell he was just about like the process of making the movies.
But again, I think John took offense to the fact that one was traditional. You know, what did that make computer animation?
Right.
But anyway, it wasn't till March of 2007 that, you know, John was on stage in New Orleans and basically confirmed that Disney was, in fact, back in the hand-drawn business. And at that point, they were going to be making The Princess and the Frog. The Frog Princess, right? With Maddie the Maid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how all that changed before that movie came out in December of 2009. And then, of course, we got Winnie the Pooh out in theaters in July of 2011. And to double back now to Treasure Planet, and again, remember, released to theaters November 2002, head-to-head with Chamber of Secrets and what that did to that movie. What do you make of the fact that Winnie the Pooh, out of all the release dates that were available...
I was just about to say that, Jim.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that Disney put it out head-to-head with Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, the eighth and final film.
The most anticipated movie probably that year. Yeah, mm-hmm. I cannot believe it. I mean, I've heard since that Dick Cook hated Winnie the Pooh and just wanted to kill it. So take that as you will, but yeah.
Well, I get that, but face it. It also gave Disney a get-out-of-jail-free card in regard to hand-drawn. You know, let's face it, you know, Princess and the Frog had a huge promotional campaign. Remember how they did showings on the lot? You know, that 2 weeks out ahead of the actual theatrical release, you could buy a package and go on the Disney lot. And there was, didn't they also show it in New York at like Roseland or?
Yeah, I remember I saw it in a screening in Times Square, and after every musical number, people applauded, and it was like, this is going to be a hit.
You know, and that was the thing, that it didn't do the numbers that Disney anticipated. In the end, you know, just sort of like, okay, we made a try at reviving hand drawn, and let's face it, there was this interesting period where they were trying to figure out if Disney now is just doing CG films, what makes a Disney computer animated film different than a Pixar animated film? And it almost took till, I want to say, Tangled before it felt like they finally they found it. I mean, face it, Bolt, you know, really could have been a Pixar film. What I find fascinating now is that Chicken Little, you know, gets absolutely no love at the company. You know, it's just sort of like, you know, that this is our attempt at a DreamWorks film, not a Pixar movie.
Right.
You know, just sort of like, anyway, to swing back to Ice Age, long story short, folks, because of what happened back in March of 2002, when Ice Age came out and that started the next wave of layoffs at Walt Disney Animation Studios. There were still folks who were working for Disney who were fired, and some folks who were still in the building who still have, you know, kind of a chip on their shoulder when it comes to Manny the Mammoth, because they feel like that's the movie that killed my career, which again isn't true. You know, as we mentioned, you know, when Tom Schumacher replaced Peter Schneider, Michael Eisner told him he had to reduce that headcount. So, you know, again, we went from 2,200 people who worked for feature animation worldwide to 1,300. But I guess that's the thing that I find so fascinating, is that these guys now have to face the fact that Disney owns the Ice Age characters. In fact, you're aggressively getting back in the Ice Age business. I don't know if you've been hearing the same things I've been hearing, Drew, about the Blue Sky is basically under orders to come up with a story for another Ice Age film.
Well, they didn't come up with a story for the last few Ice Age films, so I don't know if this is going to be much of a challenge.
we're getting invited to that jungle, folks. Now, what's kind of interesting is that consumer products, they're having meetings about it's time to bring to your local Disney store the Manny the Mammoth plush and Sid and Diego, you know, that those characters are going to show up in some form within the next year or so. And I think we've talked previously about Imagineering has been given its marching orders about figuring out how to get those characters back into the parks. So irony, Drew, is, you know, spring will be here in 20 days, but the Ice Age is unending, at least as far as Disney Company is concerned. And so get ready for more Mammoth, folks. Okay, speaking of stuff that's lingering, though, Drew, obviously, it's your birthday. You have more important things to do than record a podcast, so we should shut this down so you can go do fun stuff with Katie and Nova the Wonder Dog. But again, folks, remember, if you want to wish Drew a very happy birthday, do it by buying a copy of his first ever book, The Art of Onward, which Chronicle Books is officially publishing on March 3rd, this Tuesday. And again, we already talked about the situation in Venice, but you were mentioning that you've got some great stuff coming up.
We've got some big heavy hitters, Jim. I'm going to just put it out there right now. We just talked to Marianne Brandy and Mary Jo Markey, who did the editing for Mission Impossible 3. Marianne just edited a little movie called Rise of Skywalker, which we get into a little bit, which is very illuminating. But it was an amazing conversation. And we've got some really great guests this week, too, lined up. all heading towards our 100th episode. Hopefully we're going to have something special for that. So, but Jim, I also wanted to say that you left out a very funny story from your Ratatouille episode with Len, which is, what? Remember when the model for the ride was in that like bank somewhere?
Oh yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That it was, because that was when Disneyland Paris was being controlled by those banks. And there was a full model of the attraction, like, years before it was actually built in some bank in Paris, which I think is so funny.
Yeah. But again, to explain the situation, because, again, what was it, 94, Frank Wells makes the deal with, you know, all the banks that own all of the debt for the Euro Disney Resort. One of the conditions was when they did any expansions that they had to have, because they had basically pushed back on the, okay, we'll let you figure out a few years about the debt. Shareholders had the right to, you know, review any expansions, any new attractions, and vote about whether or not they wanted to go forward with this. So from that point forward, I kept trying, you know, whenever they do, like when they did their Tower of Terror, it's like, okay, where's the bank lobby that has the model of Tower of Terror, you know?
And, I love that.
Yeah. You know, the downside of Disney now taking over, you know, what was it year before last where they bought that remaining 75% of the stock that was outstanding. So now it's privately held. So, you know, we're not going to get quite as much information. Though, did you just see last week that they did that story about Arendelle?
Yes.
That's being built?
Yeah.
But yeah, what is it? They're going to have the Arendelle Castle. There's going to be the mountain with Elsa's palace in the background. But I guess the thing that most intrigued me was the notion that the seaport that Arendelle is going to be built around, from day one, that's built to basically have a World of Color type show right in the lagoon space. So
yeah. It'll be interesting to see if any of this stuff gets built or if the coronavirus wipes those plans out as well. But
yeah, let's remember, folks, that, you know, in 2008, you know, I still remember getting called from, you know, friends who were working at Walt Disney World where they had the portal. And I guess by accident, you know, somebody in Glendale put the wrong file up on the portal, and it was the 2 minute long coming soon to the parks or coming soon to Disney Hollywood Studios was the Monsters, Inc. Scream Coaster.
Right.
And, you know, when the financial correction happened in 2008, that went off the table. Hyperion Wharf, you know, that fell off the table. So, yeah, people need to be aware that, you know, that's the other thing with the coronavirus, that a lot of this stuff could be, you know, that's been announced may not happen. So,
right.
Cherry Tree Lane.
Jim, you had something in your throat there.
There we go. Okay. But on the other hand, we'll cover some of this stuff on some of the other podcasts over at Jim Hillmeter. Disney Dish with Len Testa, Looking at Lucasfilm with Dan Z, I Want That with Michelle Valladolid, Marvelous Disney with Aaron Adams, gentleman who does a lot of editing here, and of course, the show I do with Dustin Fuse, Universal Joint. Tell you what, folks, if you could do Drew and I a favor and head on over to iTunes and rate and recommend not only Fine Tuning, but also Light the Fuse, which, again, going to have some cool Rise of the Resistance stories. Excuse me, Rise of Skywalker. Oh,
Rise I hate of that Skywalker, they named them that close. I know.
Okay. But on the other hand, if you really, really, really like what we do here, if you get over to Bandcamp and subscribe, that would be great. And again, Light the Fuse has a social media presence, right?
Yes. We're on Twitter, Instagram, everything. Go follow us. And okay. Yeah, I hope we have some stuff to announce on this podcast soon, too.
This is true.
For everybody.
This is
true.
Okay. And speaking of social media, you can find us over at Twitter and Instagram under Jim Hill Media, one word, and then over at Facebook at Jim Hill Media News, all one word. So, all right, I think that'll do it for today, folks. And again, on behalf of the people who'll be writing to me about Treasure Planet, I liked the movie. I really did. It almost shut down feature animation. But that's a story for another time.
Yes. All right.